Last week, as we were considering Paul's ruthless, duplicitous, indeed insane, attack on the Torah in Romans 7, where Paul invented a commandment that says you shouldn't be a sexual pervert, to declare that he was a sexual pervert because of the non-existent commandment, and that therefore the Torah was dead, that the Torah was a source of evil, that the Torah is what caused him to be a rotten person. That's the basis of Romans 7. So we decided that perhaps we should consider Yahweh's view on the Torah. After all, he's the author of the Torah, and my guess is that his view of it is superior to Paul's, particularly when they disagree. So we began that review in the Proverbs as well as in the Psalms. At this point, we are sharing a mizmor, a song. This is 25, 7 through 14. It begins. It says, "The sins of my youth and rebellion do not remember. As your love and mercy for me is remembered on account of your goodness, Yahweh." Now, Paul had the author of the Torah, prophets and Psalms, as mean, as incompetent, as enslaving. And this is David, that's writing and saying, you're merciful on account of your goodness. And as a result, rather than the Torah being unable to save, as is Paul's claim, Dode, who's Yahweh says is perfect, is saved from his own sins as a direct result of Yahweh's goodness, of his mercy. One of the two is lying. Which one do you think it might be if Yahweh, who just happens to be God, and Paul say exactly the opposite things regarding the Torah? Who do you think would be the most likely to be telling the truth?
Well, we've already proven that Paul's a liar, so I would think he's just consistently lying, and we haven't proven that God has lied yet, so I think I'll bet on Yahweh.
I think I will, too. You know, you've got the creator or the creation. I'm going to go with the creator here.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, it was not a very tough call.
No.
And this goes on to say, Yahweh, the Most High, Yahweh, you just happen to be God, is good. He's always right, completely correct, and consistently straightforward. Therefore, he is the source of teaching and instruction, and he guides and directs sinners along the way. So it sounds to me that Dode, this man that God loves more than anyone else, that he came to the same conclusion that you did, Kirk.
Well,
that he just said, Yahweh, the God, the Most High, is always right. He's completely correct and consistently straightforward. So his sort of teaching and guidance and direction is the resolution for guiding sinners along the way.
Yeah, and exactly. And one of the things, it just comes to mind every time I see Torah, I wrote down when the first time I read Yada yada, I wrote down it good so I could look at him, so I could remember, so instruction, teaching, guidance, direction. You know, there's nothing in there about law, so that's all absurd to begin with. So that's the perspective when I read Paul now. So it's just not, it's a totally different concept.
You know, speaking of first time, the first time that Yahweh uses the term Torah, as is his custom, he defines his term. He tells us that Torah is based upon the Hebrew verb yara. Yara was used in this particular sentence. It was translated, he is the source, because it was written in second person, or third person, I should say, in third person masculine singular, speaking of Yahweh. He is the source of teaching and instruction, and he guides and directs. That's yara, that's what it means. Torah is based on the verb yara, according to Yahweh. So how do you get law out of that?
You can't. Only a Christian can do that.
Yeah, in fact, Christians say, you know, you either obey everything that's in the law, you're condemned by the law. If that were true, you would expect that not only would Torah be law, which it isn't, it's teaching and guidance, but also you would expect that there would be a Hebrew word, obey, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm, for obey, yeah.
Is there a Hebrew word for obey?
No, sir. I haven't come across it yet.
No, there is no Hebrew word for obey. The words that when you read your various corrupt English translations and you read obey, it's always I can't say translation. It is a corruption, a misrepresentation of the Hebrew word shema.
Uh-huh.
You know what shema means?
Shema means to observe.
Shema means to observe, but it was actually they change shema to keep to infer that you know, keeping is like obeying, but shema doesn't mean keep. There's nothing associated with shamar that means keep.
Yeah.
Shamar means to focus, to be observant, to closely examine, to carefully consider is what shamar means. But no, the word that you find changed to obey in your English Bibles is shama. Very closely related to shamar, but it's shama. And shama means
deliberately.
To listen. And so the enormous convoluted leap that one has to make from listening to obeying is beyond comprehension. And yet there is no place ever in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms where Shema is used to convey anything other than listen. And what God is saying is, I want you to listen to me. You know, it's like heavenly, fatherly advice. You can choose whatever you want to do. That's up to you. You know, I gave you free will. The choice as to how you want to respond is completely up to you. But will you please listen to what I have to say?
Mm-hmm. That triggers, you know, the Mizmor song 119:33.
Yes.
You know, when it's the same, Bien Yara, Derek, Choke, Netzor.
Right. Right.
You know, and it doesn't say, it says observe the prescriptions and
right.
then respond habitually
right.
To what you've learned. I mean, that's
right.
that's a totally different concept than anything you would be told in a Christian church.
Correct.
About the
yeah.
Torah.
Right. Yeah, that's the beauty of the 119th Psalm is that the Dod isolates the four most important aspects of Yahweh's Torah teaching and guidance to focus on, to observe, and throughout the 176 verses, it's a constant reinforcement of those four things. And the most important of the four is the Mishnah, the terms and conditions of the covenant, the mitzvah. And so it's the terms and conditions of the relationship agreement. He says you really ought to pay attention to that. Now, Dod didn't have to be a rocket scientist to come up with that. Shamar mitzvah actually is etched in stone in the second of the three statements that Yahweh wrote on the first of the two tablets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it says shamar mitzvah, observe, closely examine and carefully consider, the terms and conditions, mitzvah, of the covenant as the means to receive his mercy. So to isolate on them based upon that instruction that Yahweh etched in stone doesn't take a rocket scientist. So I'm not crediting Dod for this great revelation here, but throughout the 119th Psalm in 176 verses, he's constantly encouraging us to closely examine and carefully consider the terms and conditions of the covenant.
And where can you find it?
In the Torah.
Yeah,
in the Torah, the only place which you find it. The second is the Mishpat. And the Mishpat are the means that Yahweh uses to resolve disputes. You know, Dod began here. He says, you know, I've got rebellion and I've got sin. And you resolve that based upon your goodness and your mercy. Well, the resolution for our rebellion against God, which is principally our tendency to be religious and political and militaristic and these kinds of things, The solution, the mitzvot, the solution are the seven steps that Yahweh has provided from our world to his. The doorway is Passover. That's the solution. And so mitzvot means two things, and it's the second of the four words that concepts that Dode is telling us pay attention to in the Torah if you want to understand it. If you want to be in a position to respond to it, do that. And it doesn't just mean the means to justly resolve disputes, which is the whole purpose of the seven invitations to meet with God, beginning with Passover, unyeasted bread, firstborn children, and ultimately concluding and camping out with God at Sukkah. It also means to exercise good judgment. And what that suggests is that once you observe what Yahweh is providing in terms of guidance in his Torah, you're in a position to exercise good judgment and respond intelligently, rationally, morally to the offer that he's making.
Yeah, you have to have the right perspective, so, and you have to study to get that. So.
Yes. Yeah, exercising good judgment is the antithesis, of course, political correctness, of that cancer that is destroying the ability of people in the West to be able to think. But that's what God's encouraging. Exercise good judgment. The next is the choke. And sometimes it's chuka, which would be feminine, but choke then in the masculine form. Is that which has been cut, therefore inscribed or etched in stone, therefore written and reliable, unchanging. You know, when you etch something in stone, you don't bring out the eraser. That means that what I'm saying here, you can trust because I've literally etched it in stone. So those inscribed prescriptions, which cut us into the relationship, is what choke means. Now, there are five terms and conditions of the covenant. But there are lots more insights that Yahweh etched in stone that help us understand his role vis-a-vis the covenant and how we participate in it and what we gain from it. And all of those insights that permeate his Torah guidance, Dode is saying, pay attention to those. And when we return, Kirk, we're going to talk about the fourth of the four items, which is Pukudim. And what Pukudim represents, because it's the other aspect of the Torah that we ought to pay attention to. We'll be back in a moment. The last of the four things that Dode, we know as David, the fellow that Yahweh not only called beloved, that's what Dode means, but the person that throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, Yahweh is constantly talking about how meaningful, and not so much in the Torah, but in the prophets and Psalms, how meaningful his relationship is with this individual. He has said that the Pukudim, where it was the fourth aspect of the Torah, we should really focus on. And the Pukudim represents prescriptions, which mean, you know, a doctor will give you a prescription for good health. So prescriptions that enable us to respond is the whole concept of a Pukudim. So it's a something that provides health and growth that enables us to respond appropriately to what God is offering. Those are the four things. They're all found in the Torah. So, marvelous document, the most valuable document in the universe. It's where Yahweh introduces himself to us. Is there any other place that Yahweh, God, introduces himself to us other than the Torah?
He introduced himself in the flesh. He was the walking Torah, but it's still the Torah, isn't it?
Yep. And even then, we don't have a reliable text.
Of course, no.
Yeah, to tell us what he did and said. The Christian New Testament is just horribly maintained. It's grotesquely unreliable. And I'm not saying that to be, you know, prejudicial.
I'm just
telling you, those are the facts. There is absolutely no other conclusion that can be made other than the text is so poorly maintained, it is grotesquely unreliable.
Yeah. And And they burned up all the ones in Hebrew anyway, so are buried
correct.
Somewhere.
Between the Romans and the Akiba rabbis, they destroyed the eyewitness accounts that were written in Hebrew, which would have been Yaokanan and Mataniah. And then, so that the only, you know, the only old manuscripts, the only manuscripts that we have that are written within 300 years of this time, A, are a translation. All of the conversations took place in Hebrew. And so the only text we have of what was said and done is in Greek. And I want to tell you, Greek and Hebrew are not even remotely close in terms of the languages. And then on top of that, you've got the fact that these were all found in Egypt. Not one has been found in Yisrael. And so you're a whole country away from where these things took place in a different language and then by people. When you study the influence of Romans in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century, even the historians became revisionists. They became storytellers. There was almost no correlation between what a Roman historian or a Roman political or religious leader said or wrote and what actually occurred. And they took the same revisionist approach to these accounts and ended up with something that's, well, if you were to compare the oldest manuscripts to the basis of today's translations, 180-some-odd word text, and there's over 300 known variations.
The only thing that I find comforted in it, though, is what you do find in there, it seems to be enough evidence that virtually everything that Yahusha said came out of the Torah.
Yeah,
so
you
can go back and say, okay, well, he approved it. I can go there. I can find my source in the Torah. I don't have to worry with it.
You know, I'm doing a lot more just blanket reading these days just to get a more complete understanding. I just recently read through the entirety of Mataniah, and now I'm reading Mark. And I'm going to agree with you. One of the things that's interesting is not only his constant reference to the Torah and prophets, like, you know, answered, how would you get eternal life? And he cites the most important statement in the Torah. You know, know Yisrael, Yahweh is one. You should love Yahweh with all your soul, with all of your inner nature, with all of your mental capability. And, you know, he begins with that. And almost every question he answers by citing the Torah. But there's far more to it than that. When you're reading through Mark, for example, almost every place that Yahusha goes, he's teaching. It's the universal thing. It's always he's teaching. He's not baptizing. He's not preaching. He's not found doing anything other than consistently teaching. That and healing, and the teaching always takes precedence to the healing. We'll be back. When I first came to realize what we've been talking about here, Kirk, that the Christian New Testament, that first of all, half of it is trash because it's Paul's letters. Yeah, Paul's letters and Acts and Hebrews, run by one of his disciples, is not only not inspired, it's the antithesis of God's guidance. It's an adversarial view towards God. So you have to throw away half of it just as being demonically inspired. The remaining half, most of the letters, not a whole lot of merit in them and no old examples of them. So you're in trouble there. And then the four historical presentations, two of the four are hearsay. Luke wasn't there. All he could do is piece together what he was told happened by access to people who were there. And so Luke is hearsay. And
what's his alignment with Paul?
with Blasio. For most of his life, he was aligned with Paul. And then, which is, you know, the book of Luke's and Acts are both personal letters that that Luke wrote to a friend. They were never designed to be put into a Bible. And then you've got Mark, which was a translator for some of Shimon Kephish's missions, and simply tried to compile some of what Shimon had to say. So you've got two that are questionable as hearsay, and only two accounts that are were compiled by eyewitnesses, and they were both compiled in a completely different language, of which we, the language that was spoken, and we don't have access to them. And so my initial thought was, oh boy, you know, this is supposed to be important, and yet we don't have a credible resource. And they were maintained so poorly in the translated language as to be almost worthless to try to recreate. Now, there was some ability to get back to the core by the fact that Yosha cited the Torah so often that, you know, you could take the Greek replacement words and render them back into Hebrew because he cited the Torah so often. And that was a help, particularly in Matanyahu and Yohanan. But one of the things that I discovered is that by far the most accurate, the most complete eyewitness account of Yosha's words and deeds, what he said and did and why, it's not in the Greek text, not in the Christian New Testament. It's in two of Dodes, David's Psalms, 22 and 88, and especially throughout Yashayah, Isaiah. That's where you find it. So it's not like we're lacking the insight. It's just that most people are looking in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm. And that's the most complete scroll in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
By far.
And then when they went down to the base, to Solomon's temple, and they found the biggest stones on the cornerstones in Jerusalem, they found that Yahshua is written there.
Yes.
Oh, so, yeah. I mean, that's not a coincidence, I don't think, but I mean, it was there to be discovered. But,
yeah, no, we are really, really rich. When it comes to the most important of the prophets, Yahshua, Isaiah, we have many manuscripts, and one of the manuscripts, the only entirely intact manuscript scroll from beginning to end, exists. In fact, it's displayed, and it's called the Temple of the Scroll in Jerusalem. But, you know, the Psalms is another one of those places where we have so many great extant manuscripts of the Psalms, and so many of the Torah, that, you know, we're really in very, when it comes to the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, we have magnificent source material to work with. And what we do find is that the Masoretic, which was originally compiled in Aramaic, a translated language, in Babylon, it's in conjunction with the Babylonian Talmud, and then disseminated around the world via Babylon, that it's only wrong on average one word in 12 to 13. Now, one in 12 to 13, you know, what's that 7% error rate? That might sound like a lot when you're dealing with the Word of God, but by comparison to the Christian New Testament, where there are twice as many errors as there are words, you know, that's reasonable. And also, we have this magnificent cache of scrolls from the area above the Dead Sea and the cliffs of Qumran.
And if you know what they were changing, primarily what the rabbis were changing, then it's pretty easy. It's pretty specific on all the things they kept changing. I mean, the references to Masayah and so forth. I mean, once you get that down, then that cuts out a big chunk of it right there.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that you learn very early on is that the Masoretes tried to vocalize a language, an alphabet, that already had five vowels. And so there's this whole concept of, you know, it's a consonant-only language, and you need these, the Masoretic diacritical points to be able to determine what word is being conveyed. And once you recognize that, that's just not the case. It is an outright lie. There's 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, five of which are vowels. And once you recognize that, then what you can do is get beyond the diacritical markings. And you can now look up each word based upon the base letters and then go to the verbal root, because almost every important Hebrew noun is defined by the actionable aspect of those letters, which is presented in the verbal root of the noun. You can really go back to original meaning and, you know, I would say 98-99%, because you have the Dead Sea Scrolls that cover such a huge percentage. You were only dealing with about 7% Masoretic error, particularly once you reverse the diacritical markings that get right back to the original language. So, our ability to know what Yahweh intended for us to know in the Hebrew text is really extraordinarily fine. We're in the opposite situation there that we are with the Greek text.
And you know, I know we talked about this one time before, but also the Greek use of language in philosophical things, where the Hebrews were talking very how do you say it, earthly things. I mean, they weren't the words, if you put them in the context of the way they thought, as opposed to the way a Greek person would think, which is kind of trapped in their own language frame, then it's then you understand it even more, I think.
I would agree with you about 90% there.
Uh-huh.
The Greek language was defined by Greek philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. And Greek philosophy was defined at the time by Gnosticism, which is Paul's letters are almost universally Gnostic. The flesh is bad, the spirit is good. So Gnosticism, and Gnosticism is the thing that Plato, for example, promoted, the fact that the physical world was corrupt and it was just a pale and corrupted reflection of the perfect spiritual realm that existed out there someplace. Well, he was wrong. And Gnosticism is huge, and so philosophy is huge as a driving force in the Greek language. The Hebrew language is focused on relationships. Every Hebrew verb has a relational stem. And so, unlike any other language, the language itself is defined by relationships. Now, what those stems do is they tell us the relationship between the subject and the object of the verb's action. So the subject and the object interact through the action of the verb. The stems tell us who is doing what to whom, and the reaction and the interplay between the subject and the object. And since throughout the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, the subject and object are almost universally
Yahweh and us.
You and me and Yahweh, the interaction between us is the essence of that language.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second part of Hebrew that is so powerful and yet not conveyed in other languages is that the preponderance of verbs are rendered in within a volitional context, within the auspices of free will. And there are Hebrew moods that convey first, second, or third person volition. And the volition is more than just choice. It's also will, intent, desire.
Attitude.
Yeah, attitude. So here's
I know when you're talking about this tablets of stone, though, I mean, that for those that are listening, maybe for first time or something.
It's
a tremendous difference.
That's why when you take something out of Hebrew and try to convey it in Greek, you lose the relational aspect of the verbs, which is, you know, the whole purpose of creation is for the covenant relationship. So you lose the single most important aspect of what is being conveyed, which is the relationship between the subject and object, God and ourselves. It's just gone in every other language, unless you replace the stems by, you know, a handful of words to try to recreate that relationship. Then the second is the volitional moods. We don't have a language that says desire. You know, when you're conveying, Yahweh was saying that he is merciful, for example. We don't have a language that enables us, without adding a lot of words, to say it's God's desire to be merciful. It's his choice that we choose to take advantage of what he's offering. And yet that's always conveyed through these moods. Now, the third thing that is unique to Hebrew, and perhaps it is the most powerful, is the fact that every Hebrew verb is true throughout time. That there's not a single Hebrew verb that is constrained by time. So whatever God says, well, we in English are prone to try to put it into past, present, or future tense. There aren't such tenses in Hebrew. There is no tense in Hebrew that constrains an action to time. Powerful. And the reason that's important is because everything with Yahweh is true throughout time. He is eternal. You know, his name is based on Haya, which means I was, I am, I will be. I exist. And so the text of the Hebrew Torah, prophets, and Psalms fits perfectly who Yahweh is. It is Yahweh in our world because of the infinity of the verbs. We're having a conversation with Kirk regarding the uniqueness of Hebrew and why it's so important.
Can I add a quick footnote?
Please.
Well, it's also in regards to time. Time is only relevant in regard to matter. And
correct.
One day we will be more out of time than in time, because
right.
We'll be more on a spiritual plane. So, and his word is still going to be good even beyond time.
Correct.
Which should be comforting to you, because that means he's not going to change his mind when we change it into a different state.
Correct.
So, I mean, no matter where we go, what happens, what he creates, it'll always be true.
When Yahweh was introducing himself to us in Bava Sheath during the creation process, what thing did he equate himself to say, if you want to understand what I'm like, what am I like? What did he say he was
light.
Like? Light.
Light.
And on a photon of light, does time flow?
No, you just see it all right in one instance.
Yeah. On a photon of light, time simply is. Light and the Hebrew verb haya, was, is, will be. Exactly the same concept. That's why when we read the prophetic accounts and the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and Yahweh is predicting what's going to happen through the course of human history, he's not predicting anything.
No, he's seen it.
He's already seen it. He's just witnessed our future and reported in our past what he witnessed in our future.
And he was kind enough to do it, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, what it does, and he's quite clear about it. He says, since I'm the only one that can do that, by doing it, I prove that I, God, am the author of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, so that you can trust what it has to say. That's the only reason that he did it. But it's important because, and you've hinted at this, Kirk, is that we are going to be made, transformed into spiritual beings, which means that we, too, are going to be unconstrained by time. Now, the reason that's really important is that as light, as an energy-based being, we become instantly immortal and eternal. That's a good thing. Time never comes to an end. But also, this universe is really big. You know, it's probably in the range of 30 billion light years across. That means even at the speed of light, it would take you 30 billion years to get from one end to the other. That's without stopping. And yet, as an energy-based entity, it will take you absolutely no time to get from one end to the other, because time doesn't flow. You know, speed is always, you know, and distance are always related, because we're stuck in the ordinary flow of time. So speed, which is distance over time, becomes irrelevant when time is no longer relevant. And so you can be at one end of the universe and the other in no time.
And for lunch.
Oh, absolutely. Time to pack a lunch. And one of the things we're told is that we will have corporeal capability in eternity, which means that, you know, when we want to camp out on some planet that's in some emerging solar system and enjoy life and enjoy the sun on that, the star on that planet, and enjoy a good meal and a good time and a good song and the like, we'll be able to do so. And it been for a moment to be stuck in the ordinary flow of time only to reemerge and no longer be constrained by it. So that's a huge aspect of what Yahweh is offering us. That's why he took Abraham to the stars to show what he was inheriting. You know, an essential aspect of what God's offering. Now, there's one other aspect of Hebrew that is uncommon to other language. There are two conjugations of Hebrew verbs, the perfect and the imperfect. In the perfect, we're dealing with a completed action. It could be a completed action in the past, present, or future. It doesn't reference time, but a completed action, the totality of the action. And with the imperfect, we're talking about ongoing, unfolding actions. Now, you might say, okay, so what's the big deal on that? Well, for example, when Yahweh acts and he does something on our behalf, it's in the perfect. He has done everything that needs to be done. The totality of what needs to be completed to deliver the desired result, he does.
Of course, his actions are contradicting Paul now.
His actions are perfect.
Help him out.
Yeah. I'm happy to contradict Paul. The second is in the imperfect. This was such a release when I came to realize this. You know, for example, the 10 statements that Yahweh etched in stone, 7 of those are instructions. And every one of those instructions is written in the imperfect. So it doesn't say, you know, if you kill once, then you've broken this instruction. If you've committed adultery once, you've broken the instruction. If you've borne false witness once, you've broken the instruction. It doesn't say that. It says, don't make a habit of killing. Don't make a habit of ongoing throughout your life of bearing false witness. My guess is that you've borne false witness once or twice. You've said things that turned out not to be true. I know I have. But the moment you cease doing it, you're no longer guilty of it. Now, not only does Yahweh have a solution for our guilt when we fail, and that's the purpose of the Torah, but the instructions themselves deal with us as we really are. We're incapable of being perfect. He's not asking us to be perfect. He's written all of those instructions in the imperfect. Don't make a habit of coveting. Don't make a habit of making false statements. Isn't it marvelous what the power, the insights, the enlightenment that we gain from the Hebrew?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, boy, I'm glad that Yahweh created this language to benefit us. Thank you, Kirk. We'll be with you tomorrow.
Sir.